Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I want to start with a social justice issue that's also an eco issue. Of course, all of global warming is effectively a social justice issue. But this is one of those inadvertent things that I just have to do a shout out on, even though it's tangentially related. And it's related via the concept of air pollution and these large and even small cruise ships. Now, a small cruise ship, by the way, is like 60 beds. And that's the size of the cruise ships that are traveling all over the Arctic Circle. We're going up there and looking at Alaska, and we're so excited to be seeing the glaciers and the beautiful blue water. And what we don't understand is that the carbon tax or the carbon load is really substantial for these cruises. In fact, in major areas in Europe, such as Venice and other places that have allowed cruise ships in and are getting lots of, basically they keep the engine running while they're in port so that they can keep the generators running, so that they can keep the air conditioner running. And this thing is the size of a small skyscraper. So these horizontal buildings use a lot of juice and they burn a lot of gas. And the gas that they burn is closer to airplane fuel than car fuel in terms of the amount of particulates and carbon that they release into the atmosphere. These are not clean burning engines. As a result, when the city's air quality indexes have deteriorated dramatically, and this is not good for the populations that live there, I also want to point out that when we're talking about ecologically fragile zones, particularly snow and ice, that these particles are carbon. They're black. So they darken the snow and make the snow more absorbent to heat, therefore accelerating the very melting of the thing that people come to see. So I'm putting a call out to all of the people who hear me not to take that Alaska cruise. Content yourself with watching beautiful videos on YouTube. In fact, you might want to reconsider the whole cruise concept, but certainly take a look at the data on the ecological impact that these cruises have, not just on your microbiome, which gets devastated by all the sugar and calories that you consume, but more importantly, the macro ecosystem. You know, as we are to the microbiome, the planet is to us. So just, you know, think that through. Another social justice issue, this one more germane directly to healthcare, and that's a drastic increase in accidental infant deaths in bed. These rates have tripled between 1999 and 2016. And the primary group, although it has gone up in all groups, the primary groups of children that are dying are non-Hispanic black children. And throughout, this came out in Maternal and Child Health, and it's gone up across the board, but the rates among the non-Hispanic black children are really, really scary. So overall, we're talking about sudden infant death syndrome, and about 25% of that is totally preventable. It's accidental suffocation. You can tell, but when you do an autopsy, which one it was. So in 1999, the overall rates in the country were 10 per 100,000 live births. That's for SIDS. Now it's 45.100 per 100,000 live births in 2016 among non-Hispanic black female infants. It went from 15 to 53.8 for non-Hispanic black male infants, and from 5.9 to 15.8. So it started out half, and it went up, well, basically it went up 30%, 15.8 for white babies. And I'm going to drop the non-Hispanic because it's a mouthful and I'm going to be saying this a lot. So we've got white babies and black babies. It went from 6.2 to 26 for white males. Girls have a little bit lower rates of SIDS. That's known. Here's another interesting statistic about this. 83% of all SIDS death among both black and white children occurred to mothers living in the Midwest and the South at the time of delivery. And so let's take a look at some states in the Midwest. Non-Hispanic blacks in Michigan, 126 per 100,000. 11 per 100,000 for blacks in California. More than 10 times, a little bit more than 10 times more SIDS deaths. What's going on here? Non-Hispanic whites, 45 per 100,000 in Mississippi, and the lowest in California at 6.5. Here's something also very interesting. Alabama has 41, and Mississippi had 115. So what's up with that? Why are they having more deaths? And these states are close together, so it can't be something like air or a virus or the water or a mineral. It's something in the air, all right, and what it is poor education and unequal health care. And that's a real social justice issue, in my opinion. So the CDC says that it's about 25% of the sudden infant death rates that are preventable, accidental suffocation. We don't know what's gone on here. Has there been a change in the physiology of infants over a 20-year period? Has there been a change in the education of mothers? Has there been a change in pediatric education? Have we maybe stopped giving guidance about sleep posture and about keeping the stuffed toys and the blankets out of the baby's crib? Is there more co-sleeping? Because that's in some kind of internet meme that I haven't come across. I, honest to God, have no idea, but I am sure that there are people working feverishly on the problem in the wake of this data. We also know that breast cancer survival, prostate cancer survival, most cancer survivals, in fact, cardiovascular disease survival, diabetes survival, splits quite distinctively along racial lines. So as we move into talking about what our priorities and what our values are, and we think about equal justice, I think equal opportunity to not die is, you know, even arguably more important than the justice of receiving equal pay for equal work or the justice of having access to bank loans or the justice of having similar behavior on the part of the police during an encounter. I think all of these things, we need to take a good, long, hard look at our society and what we allow to occur. An apple carries about 100 million bacteria, and most of the microbes are inside the apple. That means you're not going to be able to wash off the germs, and I think that's really important. And by the way, to those of you who eat the skin, go you. You get extra fiber, extra flavonoids, and you're quaffing about 10 times as many bacteria as Oh, and eat the core, too. There's a lot of bacteria in the core, so maybe run the thing through a juicer. Here's the scoop. Organic apples harbor a more diverse and balanced bacterial community. That means they could be both tastier and maybe healthier because the bacteria end up in your bowel, and they colonize the gut, at least transiently, and the fungus in the apples tend to be the protective ones. There are also some bacteria's versions of Escherichia and Shigella, that's E. coli, that are found in conventional apple samples, but not in organic apples. And the reverse is true of lactobacilli. There's also a bacterium called methylobacterium, and it enhances the synthesis of strawberry-flavored compounds. It's more abundant in organic apples, especially in the peel. And by the way, one more thing on the fungals. The apple microbiome being more diverse and the fact that it's been shown to colonize and that the fungal community is variety-specific means you need to look at eating a bunch of different apples, not just the red delicious. And I want to comment a little bit about a blind spot. You've seen studies where they look at organic versus conventionally grown things. And from a epidemiological standpoint, when you look at the population who mostly eats organic, they're healthier and they have less cancer. And it's true. You can see a statistical difference. But it's like, well, they also probably have different behaviors and more money. And there's lots of confounds, as we call it, that could account for the difference in cancer rates. But other studies analyzing the nutrients found in organic versus conventionally grown foods find, well, vitamin content's not that different. The flavonoid content, 10-12% different, doesn't seem like it could be what accounts for these observed cancer differences. But maybe we've had a giant blind spot up until very recently because we simply didn't understand that organically grown things are going to have different bacteria. When you stop and think about it, of course, it makes sense. If you're using pesticides, you're probably killing some of the stuff. Maybe the organic benefit, the organic secret sauce, isn't just the absence of pesticides directly. Maybe it's actually also the presence of those extra flavonoids and, more importantly, the presence of a different contribution to the microbiome that causes this to be a functional food in a different way than it would be if it was grown conventionally. So I think that's fascinating. I do want to get to our first caller. That is Michael in Santa Cruz. Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Very good. Yeah. So I've been dealing with what I'm assuming is gout for well over 2 years. Presently, allopurinol has been given to me by doctors at the VA.
Allopurinol, yes, go ahead.
I've been taking a tablet of that a day for the past 40 days. And I have really restricted no beer, God, no beer, no shellfish, limited red meats, staying away from the purined vegetables that I can't have that I love. And so I've really limited my diet. And what's interesting is it's gone from my right toe to my left toe in the last 3 days.
All right.
And I'm just wondering how much longer will I have to be taking these pills? And is this just something that I'm going to have to live with?
Okay. Well, let's start with the fact that if all they gave you was allopurinol, then I'm sorry to say that they have not given you optimum therapy for gout. And so let's start with what gout is, just for our audience. I'm sure you've Googled it, but gout is a condition where people have high blood levels of uric acid, which is something that your body makes when it's breaking down proteins. And the uric acid circulates in your bloodstream, and it, of course, sort of diffuses into your joints. But then in your joints, it can crystallize. And just like if you don't drink enough water, you can get a kidney stone. Those crystals are generally calcium carbonate or calcium oxalate. In the case of a gout, it's a different crystal entirely, uric acid. And there are two different kinds of gout. There's people that break down protein to make lots of the purines of the uric acid. They take the purines and they turn them into uric acid, basically. And there's people who just don't pee out enough uric acid, and they can just accumulate, kind of like when the sink gets partially plugged and you leave the water on and go answer the phone, you come back and it's overflowing. So as long as you only run the water for short periods of time, you won't overflow. So We did talk, it looks like the, we did talk a bit about gout last week, and so I do want you to go look up the last week's podcast. And so when I mentioned about the peeing, that's what I talked about on that. I talked to about to this guy about probenecid. I think it was a phone. I think it was a email, actually, if I recall correctly. But anyway, probenecid helps you pee out the uric acid, and that's an old, hopefully still cheap generic drug. Don't get me started on that one. Subject of a future rant. But the idea is if you pee out some of it, then the sink is draining faster and you don't get this crystallization phenomenon. Once you get right. the crystals, however, there was a fat, there are two fabulous drugs. And any of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs will work. So even ibuprofen will help reduce the inflammation, and that's a really good thing. And it also makes you pee out more uric acid. So we tend to use drugs in the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory class. But even more importantly is a drug called colchicine. And here's where we get a little bit on the soapbox. Colchicine is like so old that it was a drug before there was an FDA. And so when they finally like solidified the FDA, they had all these old grandpa drugs that, you know, and they were like, well, you know, these things are being made by a bunch of generic manufacturers, and we aren't, you know, eventually we'll get around to making them prove that the drug is good, you know, but we're going to assume that since it's been used for, you know, six generations, that it's probably okay to give it, and we'll just, you know, give it a pass for now. And that's called grandfathered in. But eventually the grandfathering died, and about a close to a decade ago, the FDA finally got down on its list, and it got to colchicine, and it said, all right, so any one of you manufacturers who's making this, you're going to have to go and do the new drug studies, and you're going to have to prove it's safe, and you're going to have to prove it's effective. And if you spend the money to do that, we'll treat it like a new drug and give you an exclusive patent for 17 years, which one company took them up on it, made, you know, got the investment, did the research, and they got a new drug patent. So the price of colchicine promptly went up by about a hundredfold. It went from being like, you know, 15 cents to $15. And, you know, and so because it was so expensive and you couldn't get it approved from insurance, the drug sort of fell out of people's brains. So we've forgotten it exists. We've forgotten that you can give people colchicine and that it shuts down the pain rapidly. And so if you don't have an ulcer, then you can, and, you know, I need to remind you, this is, I'm not your doctor. I don't have your medical record here, but over the counter, I think I can safely say that you can take an over the counter agent called ibuprofen, and you can go look up what online, what the maximum medical dose of ibuprofen is. And unless you have kidney problems or ulcers, you can probably take that for a week with food and drastically flip this thing away. And now then the allopurinol will keep you from making as much uric acid in the future. So again, your sink's not overflowing because your production has been cut. And you can, I personally, back in the day, the way I was trained, back in the old days, was you're going to actually measure someone's urine for 24 hours and see how much uric acid they put out. Because if they are classified as an overproducer, they'll put out a ton of uric acid because they're making too much of it. And they're the allopurinol group. And if they're an under excreter, because they're just not peeing out the amount that would be proportional to what's in their bloodstream, you give them probenecid or Benamid, because then you're fixing the actual problem rather, and you're doing it in the way that is the safest way, because the probenecid is much, much safer than allopurinol. Some people will have these nasty idiosyncratic reactions to the drug. It's rare, and we give it, and I don't think I've seen more than one case in 30 years, so it's not like you need to be terrified about this reaction. You should educate yourself about the signs and symptoms of it, which off the top of my head, I don't even remember. I've just got it labeled in my brain as nasty reaction. You know, if someone's on allopurinol and they come with something weird, go look up the reaction and make sure that this is not characteristic of it. But those are my words of wisdom, a good diet. They gave you good diet. But basically, if you're an overproducer, that won't be enough, and you'll need the allopurinol. But first, you got to get the bloody crystals cleared out. And what the colchicine does is it stops the inflammatory cells from moving as much, so they don't move around and chomp up all of the crystals and then get their vesicles pierced. And essentially, it's like it's as if the cells are killed by the uric acid that they are trying to swallow like an amoeba, and then they release a lot of chemicals that are inflaming your joints. So you want to stop the process at the front end and then wait for it to settle out, and eventually it will balance out, and hopefully you'll be able to liberalize your diet a little bit and just behave yourself with the alcohol, which is a major contributor.
Yeah.
Much more so than the veggies.
Oh.
Sorry about that.
I know.
Well, I know. If it's any comfort, Henry VIII suffered greatly from gout.
Yeah.
So you have a disease of kings, sir.
Well.
Kings and princes.
I want to thank you again, and keep up good work, and ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen. Yeah, at medical strength.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Well, bye for now, and keep listening.
Yes, sir.
All right. Bye-bye. And let's go to big news for Parkinson's disease. You don't need you don't need a vagus nerve stimulator implanted deep in your brain. It's proof of concept. A randomized controlled study coming out of the University of Kent, England. I love the English because they have National Health. They're always funding people to go find a cheaper way to do things, which is just absolutely does not happen in this country. You cannot get funding to do research to figure out a cheaper way to do things because we haven't closed the loop. You know, can you say broken market? Anyway, what they showed was twice daily stimulation of the ear for 2 months. This is ear canal, easily located with your pinky. It was associated with a significant reduction in both motor and non-motor features of Parkinson's disease. Participants had greater movement and mobility, but also improvements in cognition, attention, decision-making, mood, and sleep. And they found it easier to be independent. And the most of the gains were greatest about 5 weeks after the end of treatment. So this is something that once you get it rolling, it appears to keep rolling. This was using a portable headset that's been produced exclusively for clinical investigations by a company called Xi'an NeuroStim. I believe that this is the AccuStim device, which I first saw back in the late 90s at acupuncture conventions. And you plug this into a stimulator and dial up a frequency, and it just throws a little electric buzz. Many of you who've been out on whale watching cruises may have seen people wearing those wristbands that send a little electric stimulation to the acupuncture point pericardium 6, that is a very strong nausea point or anti-nausea point. Well, the ear is a very strong vagus nerve point. And if you stimulate the ear manually or with needles or with electricity, you get a rather profound signal going to the vagus nerve. And the signal that about 10 hertz or 10 beats per second is usually the one that's used for this calming. And this was something that I have used, and I have the device in my office. I use it for people who are needle phobic. It's actually a little more uncomfortable than needles because it's a little buzzy, just like the wrist thing. And that sensation is not horrible, but it's enough to be unpleasant, so why not do the least unpleasant thing? It'll be interesting to see whether a mechanical stimulation, like a little vibratory thing, would work as well. I wonder if there might be certain music that you could play through earbuds that would provide some benefit. Anyway, these are simple things that might make a big difference and do not involve the use of drugs, and are in fact working directly with the nervous system, something I always encourage. This was a very exciting thing. We have often talked on this program about molecular cancer diagnosis, about cancer biopsies or blood biopsies, screening for changes in the DNA, because at this point we've been studying it for about 14, 15 years, and we have a pretty good idea which genes are methylated, hypermethylated, which means they have lots of CH3 groups, carbon and three hydrogens, kind of glommed on there, a bit like barnacles on a boat. And there's a technique to just take a sample and run it through a kind of enzyme, and then run that on run an analysis on the fragments, and certain fragments showing up tell you that you just digested cancer tissue versus normal tissue. And in breast cancer, this could be a very, very big deal on many places on the planet. So the technique is called methylation sensitive restriction endonuclease, and that's the enzyme, a restriction endonuclease, and it just chops up DNA. But it chops, let's, you know, it's GGATT. Well, in this case, it's GGAT methylated T methylated T. And so if you've got three methylation groups in that little fragment, it's going to cut five spaces ahead and just, oh, I got my three T's, I'll go back five spaces and clip. Something similar to how CRISPR works. And these endonucleases were originally derived or isolated from bacteria many years ago, and they were fundamental to our now highly DNA-driven technology. Without them, none of this could have happened. So a team working at the John Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center has developed a laboratory test that is a type of methylation-sensitive restriction endonuclease, and they've tested it. First, they derived it using breast cancers, and it's kind of cool because the problem of rapid tissue diagnosis from a biopsy is really not a big deal here. If I send in a breast biopsy, you know, it might take as much as 5 working days, but it probably won't, because if it looks cancerous, they jump on it and it gets fast-tracked, and we'll probably hear back within 48 hours. If it's a hospital setting, like a surgery done in the hospital, then a frozen section is sent off to pathology, and you'll have the results before you finish stitching up the wound. Often you'll wait to stitch up the wound, because if it is cancerous, you might want to do some other things while you're there and have the patient anesthetized. But when we talk about biopsy, and you know, let's talk about third world and developing countries. There are about 2 million cases of breast cancer a year in the world. And that's about a 3% annual increase since 1980. And some of that's just case finding, okay? But let's continue. In some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, there is one pathologist per million population. The ratio here, at least in a hospital setting, is one pathologist on duty at all times, so you've got maybe 300 people in that hospital, and you know, we're probably looking at 1 per 10,000 people in the general population or at that level. So things can get to the pathologist very rapidly. In sub-Saharan Africa, it can take months. In fact, one study showed a delay of 101 days for unpaid specimens relying on state funds, and 43 days for those who could afford to pay out of pocket. So in Mexico, it can be up to 10 months to get a pathology diagnosis going through the national health system. And yes, am I in favor of universal health care coverage? You bet I am. Am I in favor of making it a national system that depends on Congress for funding? Not so much. But that's another conversation. This technique can be applied in a developing nation. A chemical, basically, the biology sample is loaded into cartridges. It's inserted in a machine that tests for levels of gene methylation. They add a chemical that results, that breaks down some of the DNA, results in a change in gene activity, and it returns the methylation marker result for the 10 most likely to be cancer genes that were identified by these researchers. They set this up really well. They studied the genes that had already been looked at, but they also got samples from all over the world so that they were sure this was going to work in sub-Saharan Africa, it was going to work in Finland. No matter where you were, you were going to be using the right DNA for those breast cancers. So this is extremely exciting. They then went and got samples from Portugal and Hong Kong, and they got 96% accuracy. So that means 96 of those cancers would be fast-tracked to surgical removal, and hundreds of lives, if not thousands of lives, could be saved. Very exciting stuff. We're going to go to an email now. First email comes from Jade in Los Angeles. A little shout out. I'm an Angeleno by birth and still enjoy going down to visit my old stomping grounds. I was just reminiscing this weekend. Interesting, I was at a meeting of County Medical Society presidents, and the first question they asked as an icebreaker was, what was your first car and what do you remember about it? And I thought, oh, this is dumb. But as people went around the room and started to talk about it, I realized how much their answers revealed about their character, about their economic background, about their history. And I realized it was a very, very good way to get a read on people. So just thought I'd share that with you. Coming from Los Angeles, you know, we're all kind of into cool cars. But you want to know about parasites. I've traveled to Peru and have lived in the Amazon for a month and wanted to check if parasites could be causing skin, eczema, and digestive problems. Jade, you absolutely need to be tested for parasites. When the microbiome shifts, the skin shifts. And digestive problems plus skin shifting, the first place you want to go, because as Willie Sutton is reported to have said, that's where the money is the microbiome. I use several different laboratories for this sort of testing. My current favorite is a test called GI Effects by a company called Genova Labs, Genova. This needs to be ordered by a clinician, but if you contact them, they can give you a list of physicians in your area who are registered with them and probably have this test on their shelves in their storeroom, as I do, because it's one that you use all the time. It also looks at DNA, so it will be much more reliable for the identification of parasites now that you've been home for a while. The DNA testing, interestingly enough, will pick up dead parasites that might have been coming from, say, the meat that you ate, but by now you've passed everything through and can be expected if any parasite DNA is found, it's parasite DNA that's reproducing in your body and needs to be attacked. The other thing is you may have suffered a change in your bacterial microbiome or developed some fungal microbiome issues, and all of those will be picked out by this test. In addition, the testing will be able to give you some suggestions about which agents might be most effective for some of the pathogens. And I think it'd be an excellent idea if you got this testing. Another company that I use and think is just as good is called Doctors Data, but you're running into the same problem with them. Down in LA, I don't think you'll have any difficulty at all finding doctors who do this type of testing. What I will say is do not make this mistake, is do not go to your regular doctor and get the Quest parasite test or something like that, because that is a microscopic test, and the person who is doing that is not a specialist in parasites, and they don't do that many. It's one of a number of tests they do, and they're just not as practiced. And many years ago, we figured out that some things you need to specialize in. In fact, with mammograms, usually the radiologist reading the mammograms is the doctor who reads a lot of mammograms in the group, because you want that extra little intuition and skill that comes with lots and lots of repetition. And we're back. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Don. You can also pick us up by going to AskDrDon.com and subscribing to the podcast. You can also get the podcast through most vendors, distributors, I should say, of podcasts. And if you have trouble with your favorite one, please send us an email. You can go to AskDrDon.com and just hit the message. We would love to be notified of that. And let's go to our next email. This from Robert in Victoria, British Columbia. Margarine. After 3 heart attacks and 5 stents, I became vegan, cutting all unhealthy foods from my diet. However, I still eat lots of margarine on toast, potatoes, etc. I seem to recall an offhand remark you made on one of your podcasts disparaging margarine. I eat the B-Cell vegan brand. I recently had another attack and 2 more stents. Could margarine be the culprit? Well, Robert, there's probably a number of things active here, but certainly you're not helping by using the margarine. There's been studies looking at this, and one of them that I thought was particularly good, first of all margarines are vegan. Well, I mean, unless they add something that's animal derived, because it's made from vegetable oil, but there may be like homeopathic amounts of other things that are added that could be animal derived. So I'll qualify that statement. Margarine is a different kind of fat than fats that are found naturally. It's so different, in fact, that it can't be eaten by most bacteria, which is why it has such a long shelf life. I remember being shocked when I went to France and I saw margarine sitting on grocery store shelves, not in the dairy case, as we would call it, where it's refrigerated. And margarine differs from all other fats, including the unsaturated fats that are derived from seeds or plants, because the way its double chemical bonds are formed. So margarine, it goes way, way back. The Napoleonic Wars, and specifically Napoleon's scientists, because he was very big on science and they had a budget, were trying to feed the troops, and they were having problems with their supply chain, as you may remember from the march to Moscow and back. Anyway, yeah, Napoleon. So his guys figured out how to preserve oil. You bubble hydrogen through it, and as the hydrogen bubbles through, any of the double bonds, which act basically like little hinges, and they create a kink in the fatty acid bond. So the saturated fatty acids are all the bonds have hydrogen, and they are very stable. They don't move around. They're less fluid, and they're all room temperature solids, whereas the plant oils in their natural state are liquid at room temperature because they have these double bonds that allow them to kind of spin, if you will, structurally, if you think like a tinker toy sort of model here. And the way that the double bonds are formed in natural space is cis, which means that they're diagonal. I'm sorry, the cis are on the same side of the molecule, and the trans are diagonal. And trans fats, as they're called, are very difficult for natural enzymes to break down, bacterial enzymes, but also human enzymes. And I remember a study when this was all first coming out sometime in the 90s, where they said you could calculate from a butt fat biopsy whether a person, how much margarine on the average a person used versus butter, and how much fast food they ate. Because, again, fast food places, they are frying a lot of stuff, and they don't want their oil to go rancid, so they were using trans fats, which, you know, you heat them up, they liquefy, and you're deep frying something, it's plenty hot to be a liquid. But the trans fats, of course, deposit in the food, and so you could really kind of do someone was saying, oh, I've been good, I'm not eating any fast food, and I only eat olive oil, and then you do a butt biopsy. No, that's not how it was done, but we didn't actually check people on that. But in science, of course, you do check things like that, and it turned out the stuff was not leaving the body. It was just hanging around, including in the arteries. So you need to get off margarine and move to something that will not add to your body burden of lipids. It'll be something you can digest. Now, there's a lot of other factors that go into heart disease, particularly diabetes, high insulin levels, insulin resistance, very common. A lot of times people don't realize they've got that because their blood sugar is normal when they're fasting. But after a meal, it might go up to 200. That causes more insulin. Insulin is inflammatory. A tooth infection, a chronic sinus infection, these are all things that make whatever lipids you've got in your body more toxic for your arteries. So it's super important that you look at inflammation. You could get an hsCRP test. That's a blood test that will measure your inflammation. If it's above 3, you might want to, and of course, you can also have your doctor check you for diabetes. They'll be glad to do that. They'll get a 3-month running average blood sugar test called an hemoglobin A1C or a glycohemoglobin. I'm not sure of the Canadian terminology. And what will happen then is you'll start going after, if the inflammatory markers are high, then you're going to find that infection and treat it. And it could be, as I said, in your sinuses. Since you're male, it could be kind of lurking in your prostate. And so once you find it and you eradicate it and you get the inflammation down, then you reduce your risk of further events. Someone like yourself, you know, 3 heart attacks, 5 stents, you know, I would certainly be looking at lipid-lowering agents. And if you are dead set against statins, then very high dose fish oil would be, and a very low glycemic diet. And those would be things that you can definitely do. I'm sorry. I'm telling you to give up margarine. I'm telling you to give up sugar and toast and cut back on the potatoes. If you have an insulin problem, and your doctor will tell you that. But on the other hand, if you don't cut back on those things, you'll be cutting back on everything in the not too distant future. And that sort of sword hanging over your head is definitely a good motivator for diet. Very big and very useful new test. Also, I think going to finally put the nails in the coffin of the old medical adage that chronic fatigue is chronic laziness, or that it's all in people's heads, because now there's a biomarker. See, once we have a test, something really exists. Otherwise, it's debatable. So researchers have developed a nanoelectronics assay to measure the impedance. That's basically how much of the flow of the current is slowed down. So it's related to resistance. So what's the impedance of the electrical circuit as it's passed through white blood cells? These are the mononuclear white blood cells, and the ones that go up in mononucleosis. They take a blood sample and they give the blood, they incubate the cells, they grow them up in for a while, and they grow them in plasma that comes from the patient. So the patient is a person who supposedly has chronic fatigue. So you draw their blood, spin it down, get the plasma. Then you take these cells that you've grown in tissue culture, I guess from anyone, doesn't have to be from the patient, and you subject them to osmotic stress. So you put a little extra salt so that the cell has to work harder to keep its internal environment healthy. And in all of the people with chronic fatigue syndrome, but none of the healthy controls, the resistance or impedance rose drastically after you put the salt in the solution. So those cells, because what's important about this is that this is a simple blood test. Serum is easy to get and non-invasive, and we have an endless supply of it as long as we're drinking water. This is perfect sensitivity, which is huge. It's an inexpensive device. It'd be easy to make and distribute, and it needs to be further validated, okay? We need to try it in people with multiple sclerosis. We need to try it in people with depression and make sure that it really is specific for chronic fatigue. But obviously, multiple sclerosis has a had other diagnostic studies, and depression has a lot of other things along for the ride. Just being able to differentiate a person who's depressed because they have chronic fatigue from a person who's depressed and therefore feels fatigue would be huge. And this is validating because everybody with chronic fatigue has been suspected of being a malingerer. They've been suspected of being having some sort of mental illness. They've been suspected of dishonesty or secondary gain. And people just don't accept that this is a real disability. It can be extremely difficult to get reimbursement or get on disability with this as your diagnosis. So now we finally have a, potentially at least, a simple blood test that makes it much more scientific and sort of easier for everybody to get their head around it. So of a story, I thought it's always important to talk about weight gain and why not letting yourself gain weight as an adult is important. This latest study was published in the American Academy of Neurology, and it looks at weight gain accelerating brain aging, they say by at least a decade. So these were people who developed cortical atrophy, thinning of the cortex, cortex of the brain. This really implies that obesity reduces gray matter and that it is a causal effect. Let's see, there were 1,200 people with an average age of 64. At the beginning of the study, they measured their waist circumference and their BMI, body mass index. And 6 years later, they had an MRI, and they measured their waist again and looked at their body. And so here's what they found. The normal weight group, which was 54% women, had an average waist of 33 inches. The overweight group had an average waist of 41. The people with the higher BMIs had thinner cortices of the brain, even after control for alcohol use, smoking, and blood pressure. Every 1 unit increase in BMI was associated with a 0.1 millimeter thinner cortex, and obesity made it worse. Thinner cortex increases your risk of dementia and Alzheimer's, and it seemed to be a associational study, so we can't prove that the weight is causal. Maybe a thinner cortex makes you eat more. You know, it's possible, but I think the other one, there's mechanisms for that that make a lot more sense. Now, another study, there's a link between sugary drinks and cancer. You've heard this before. This is yet another study published in the British Medical Journal. And important here, I think, because the consumption of sugary drinks has increased worldwide, and there's more obesity, and obesity is recognized as a strong risk factor for cancer. But this one didn't look at that. It looked at non-obese patients. This is a study done in France. They looked at 100,000 healthy French adults, about 20% men. And then they did a diet questionnaire online, and then were followed for 9 years, and those who drank either sugar-sweetened beverages like soda or fruit juice and artificial diet beverages were calculated, and they compared for cancer incidence, and they controlled for age, sex, smoking, et cetera, all of the other things we know about. Basically, there's a 22% increased risk of breast cancer, 18% increased risk for cancer overall. They did not see an increase for prostate or colon cancers, but there weren't that many, so there might be a small effect they missed. None of the artificial diet beverage were associated with cancer. I still don't recommend them for lots of reasons. They are, in fact, associated with obesity, and so that may just have been a weaker effect. I think high insulin levels and the inflammation that goes along with high insulin levels is a factor here. But also, in a related study, cancer cells use sugar. They need sugar way more than normal cells. Normal cells have other options. And furthermore, for every molecule, when you have a molecule of glucose, you have three two-carbon groups because it's a six-carbon sugar. Each of those bonds between the carbons, when it's run through a mitochondria, produces like 36 molecules of ATP. And you also can run other two-carbon groups from fat through the same process. So this is super important. And in cancers, we've known that they use more sugar, but there's a wonderful mechanism here, and it's electrical. So in mitochondria, a lot of electrons accumulate. And if you, in cancer cells, because they have converted to converting sugar into energy using glycolysis, which is what bacteria do, they downregulate their mitochondria. So they like put the clutch in, keep the mitochondria from spinning, and all those free electrons build up inside the cell, and that starts to interfere with glycolysis. So the cancer cells use a safety valve, like the valve on a pressure cooker, to get rid of these electrons. And as the electrons pass outside of the cancer cell, you can pick it up electrically. So there's a voltage difference in cancer cells, and you can actually look at cancer cells, check the electric current, and know whether or not the cancer cell is metastatic and capable of spreading, or whether it's non-invasive. So the researchers engineered cells to reduce the number of this PMET safety valve, this vent valve, if you will, for the electrons. And what they found was that in their mutated cells, the cells went into overdrive and were dumping electrons. And they were using all of their resources to dump the electrons so they didn't die. So guess what? They stopped dividing. So we can't, at this point, go in with CRISPR and kill a cancer by changing this threshold. But we might be able to affect this with drugs in a controlled fashion. It could be a new chemotherapy drug. And I'm most interested in it from the standpoint of a diagnostic tool. Again, like we were talking about with the breast cancer earlier, can we tell somebody what's going on in their body quickly and without anything invasive and reliably? All very good questions. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.